Good morning and welcome again to you all. Thank you so much for being with us this, the Sunday in the season following Epiphany. We are beginning, and I know it seems like spring is far, far away. We just had a big snow this week, but we are beginning to take just the smallest peek at our journey to Lent. And what do I mean by that? Well, of course, Jesus, in the passage that we got today, is beginning to hint at the sort of ministry that he is going to have. We've gone from the birth narratives that are so much a part of what we do during Advent and Christmas to Jesus' ministry beginning now. The grand beginning, in many senses, happened last week. Jesus' miracle at Cana, but really perhaps on a much more important level, Jesus' announcement of what his ministry is going to be about happens this week. As Jesus does what any adult man in the congregation might be asked to do on any given week. He stands up and he reads from the scroll. This is a very important job, and I know we do something very much like this in the Lutheran Church. We have people that we call lectors. This is a slightly different thing, but really not very far off. Because on any given Sunday, any adult man within the congregation could be selected to come forward. They would unroll a scroll, very, very expensive scrolls, by the way. Oftentimes, these would require the economic backing of an entire community just to purchase one. They were very precious, very delicate. So much so that instead of following along with your finger, people would be given a pointer with a blunt end, so that the oils from your finger might not touch the page, and there was no damage actually done to the ink or to the paper. And so Jesus stands up, and from the precious scroll of Isaiah begins to read. And he reads this incredible poem that Isaiah has written. And the whole of the book of Isaiah is broken up into basically three main parts. And in the final part, it's bracketed in on either side by calls to repentance and forgiveness and promises of God's renewal. And in the middle, there are these beautiful poems. And not only are they poems, they're poems promising something incredible. You see, when I say that the book is written in three parts, this is kind of the happy part. When Isaiah does most of his writing, it's not so happy. Isaiah is a prophet whose unfortunate task, like most prophets, is to tell Israel that God is not very happy with them. And to tell Israel that God is going to do something to the nation of Israel to bring it back to a state of faith. And let me tell you what, it's almost never that God is going to send out free gift cards or provide everybody with flowers and candy or create a new program at church in hopes that people will come back and worship. No, God's way of bringing Israel back is almost uniquely catastrophe. Something awful is going to happen, and it usually involves their enemies. In this case, the Babylonians. So God says through Isaiah, I am going to give you over to the Babylonian captivity because you've given up faith in me. You've walked away from the covenant we made. And in order to correct your misdoing, I am going to give you over to your enemies for a period of time, and you are going to go into captivity. This happens a lot in the Bible. When Jesus reads this passage, of course, the Israelites are no longer in the Babylonian captivity. We're told that a person by the name of Cyrus, who was a Persian or a Mede, depending on which word you prefer, had come in and rescued Israel from their Babylonian captivity. But now Israel is in captivity to Rome. The Romans haven't forced the Israelites out of Jerusalem. They've just forced themselves into Jerusalem and taken over power. It just happens again and again and again to the people of Israel. And again, this isn't like God looks down at Israel and goes, ah, I wasn't watching them and they got conquered again. Every time I look away, somebody conquers them. No. God warns his people specifically. If you abandon the covenant that I have made with you, I will abandon you to the consequences of your actions. And in facing those consequences, you will return to faith in me, or you'll face destruction. But I know, God says, through the prophet Isaiah, you will return to faith in me, and I, in turn, will save you. Isaiah is giving this prophecy in which God is promising that he will come to satisfy the poor, the hungry, the downtrodden, to set the captives free. Not that God is going to set anyone who happens to be in prison free. This isn't God has just determined that from here on out, everybody isn't going to be a prisoner. He's talking about Israel's captivity. He's going to come and set Israel free. And in the book of Isaiah, he's specifically talking about coming and setting Israel free from Babylon. It is for this reason that the word Messiah is used. It means one who's been anointed. You've had oil poured on your head. And this is a phrase that's used specifically to refer to Cyrus the Mede. Again, Cyrus the Persian, your preference. Because he sets the Israelites free from their Babylonian captivity. But the Israelites just keep reading this passage. Even though they're free now back in Israel, because people keep conquering them. And so they read the passage again. The Israelites read it again, now in terms of Rome. When Jesus stands up before this group of people, and he says to them, I'm going to read to you from the Bible. And then he reads to them from the book of Isaiah, where Isaiah gives all of these promises of freedom. This isn't an unusual weekend worship service. In fact, in Jesus' part of the world, because he wasn't necessarily from Jerusalem, he was sort of from the countryside, reading this passage probably would have happened on a disturbingly frequent basis, because at the top of everyone's mind was the notion and the understanding that they were in captivity. So what is going to set us free? And now 2,000 years have gone by. Israel, well, I don't know that we can truly say that Israel is free from its problems yet. Maybe it never will be. I don't know. Only God knows. But when Jesus reads this passage 2,000 years ago, he says, now in your midst, this thing that you've been looking for, this thing that you've been hoping for, has come true in your midst. I am the Messiah you've been waiting for. This is big news. This is incredible news. And next week, we'll talk about the fact that maybe it wasn't easy news. The fact that Jesus is declaring himself to be the one who is going to set the captives free, of course, read from an Israelite point of view, means he's going to kick the Romans out and Israel's going to be free again. But we know that's not what happens. In fact, the Romans remain in Israel for decades after this. Jesus, in fact, shows absolutely no interest in politics, no interest in nations, no interest in the Israelite king or Pontius Pilate or the Roman legion or even paying taxes to Caesar. When someone asks him, what should we do about the taxes to Caesar? He shrugs his shoulder and says, well, it's Caesar's money, let him have it. Why does Jesus have so little interest in worldly matters? Of course, because as he prepares his ministry, he sets out his mission goals. What is his mission goal? Is to set the captives free. Which captives? Those of us who are captive to sin, to death, to all that comes with that. Jesus has said to himself and to the congregation that joins around him, I am going to be the Messiah that sets a final freedom, a freedom that trumps all of our earthly captivities, a freedom that no person can take away from you, a freedom you can't lose, a freedom you can't have to earn because it's going to be a gift. I am going to give you a freedom. And the freedom that Jesus is going to offer us is the freedom from the power of sin. Now, we don't talk enough about sin in the world that we live in because there is a very clear differentiation within the scriptures as to what is or is not true. The Bible doesn't shrug its shoulders over moral issues and say, I don't know, you figure it out. Do the right thing. Be nice to your neighbors and it'll all work out. No. It doesn't say love your neighbors and it'll all work out. Oh, I know there are people out there who will tell you that's what it says, but it doesn't say that. That's a horrible idea. Just love your neighbors any old way they want to be loved and it'll all work out for themselves. That can lend itself to all sorts of selfish interpretations. What if what our neighbors want is really bad? What if what we want for our neighbors is really corrupted by our human nature and what we think is loving is actually destructive? No. The scriptures teach us to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. All your strength goes into the act of loving God. And in loving God, we search diligently through God's words that tell us the difference between right and wrong. And in this, we know how to love our neighbors because we know what God says is right. We know what God says is wrong. And when we pursue what God has said is right, we can love in a degree of fullness that we could not on our own. When we fall short of that, and we do all the time, that's sin. And what does Scripture tell us sin brings into our lives? Sin brings into our lives death. And death is the final fear that all human beings face. So Jesus says, I'm going to overcome that. I'm going to overcome sin by giving myself as a sacrifice on the cross for you. Isaiah prophesies this all the time, that the suffering servant is going to come and give himself for the people. Christ gives himself for you and for me on the cross in order that we might know that our sin, that which we've done wrong, is not partially forgiven, not forgiven enough, but wholly and completely forgiven, so much so that we can stand before God and know that we have been made wholly and completely clean by our faith in Jesus Christ, whose gift sets us free. And we're also free from the power of death. Yes, we as human beings may die. It happens, and we have lost more than a few members just in this last month. But we know that death is temporary. We know that Christ overcame it, and that as we share in a baptism in Jesus Christ, we share in his life, we share in his death, we share in his resurrection. We are guaranteed that death itself has no power over us. And we hold on to that with the certain knowledge that Christ has overcome the greatest of all captivity, death itself. See, Jesus says at the very beginning of his ministry what he's here to do. To set the brokenness of this world right. And in doing so, to put us all back in right relationship with God in heaven. And to provide for us the gift of life, life abundant, life everlasting.